I'm one of HRN's interns, Nina Medvinskaya, with a preview of the next episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. This week's topic, the marriage of food and danger. Sometimes, danger lurks in the food that we eat.
So instead of saying what is poisonous, I'd rather say what's not, because it's literally just the flesh and the fins.
Food poisoning doesn't just threaten our bodies, but it endangers our environment as well.
The emissions of JBS, combined with the other top five meat companies, exceed the annual emissions of Exxon, Shell, or BP.
For more, tune into this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Today's program is brought to you by 100 Bogart Street, a co-working and event space in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Learn more at 100bogart.com.
Hi, Bomb Squad. You're listening to Radio Cherry Bomb, and I'm your host, Carrie Diamond. Each week, we bring the pages of Cherry Bomb magazine to life through conversations with the most inspiring women in and around the world of food. First, let's thank our sponsors. Le Cordon Bleu. It's almost 2019. If you're thinking new year, same old me, or new year, new me, maybe it's time to say bonjour to Le Cordon Bleu. Learn more about the legendary culinary school's most prestigious professional qualification, Le Grand Diplôme, by visiting cordonbleu.edu. And let's thank Vital Farms pasture-raised eggs. Vital Farms pasture-raised eggs are better than cage-free. They are bull-free. Try for yourself. To get your coupon for Vital Farms pasture-raised eggs, head to vitalfarms.com/cherrybomb. I hope everybody out there had a good week. We're wrapping up 2018 here at Cherry Bomb HQ. On Monday night, we had a fun event at Eve Restaurant in Tribeca, celebrating alums from Le Cordon Bleu. Chef Nancy Silverton received their Outstanding Alumni Award, and Chef Alex Baker of Eve made a beautiful dinner for us. Chef Alex attended Le Cordon Bleu, as did Nancy. What else is going on? We're deep in planning mode for Jubilee 2019. Jubilee will take place on Sunday, April 7th at the Brooklyn Expo Center, and we have so many exciting things prepared for you. Early bird tickets are $250 and will be available until January 15th or until they sell out. We also have scholarship and volunteer opportunities available. Visit cherrybomb.com for more. We just got some great news from our publisher that the Cherry Bomb Cookbook is going into another printing. Thank you to everyone who has bought the book for themselves and their friends. If you don't know about our cookbook, it features more than 100 recipes from more than 100 incredible women. I love getting your DMs about your favorite recipes. It seems that the pink spaghetti from Elettra Wiedemann is the most popular dish in the book, if I had to pick one. You toss spaghetti with beets and ricotta, and the spaghetti is literally stained bright pink all the way through. It's colorful and delicious. If you don't have the book yet, definitely pink it up. Oh my God. I mean, pick it up, but it does have a bright pink cover with a big cherry, so you can't miss it. Tag me on social and let me know what you make or bake from the book. Today's episode is a two-parter. First, we'll be hearing from Elisa Marshall, the founder of Mama, a group of coffee shops in Manhattan, Brooklyn, and Toronto. The Mama spaces are chic and cozy and seriously some of the prettiest coffee shops around, thanks to Elisa's great taste and aesthetic vision. Also, Elisa's story is a great example of how childhood passions and a little bit of fate can take you in directions you never expected. Stay tuned as we travel with Elisa from Toronto to Montreal to Ibiza and beyond. After we hear from Elisa, we'll be continuing our coffee shop talk with Linda Thatch of Little Skips. I'll tell you more about Linda later, but first, enjoy my conversation with Elisa. So I want to start at the beginning. You grew up in Toronto?
Toronto.
We don't say right? I know. Toronto. Swallow that last T. But you grew up in Toronto?
I did. Yes, in the suburb.
Did you have siblings?
I do. I have one older sister.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And how about your parents?
Did they work? Both of them. My mom was super stay-at-home mom, the dream stay-at-home mom you could ever imagine. My father was an entrepreneur. He had a few different businesses himself. So that's kind of where I got the bug.
And you said your mom was a super stay-at-home mom.
Oh, yes.
What do you mean by that?
She still to this day will bring breakfast in bed and make your bed and pack everyone's lunch and do everyone's laundry. And I was the most unindependent child ever growing up. Amazing cook. And, you know, she was there every day picking us up from school for every break that we had, every field trip. So her life was really dedicated to us.
So mom was cooking, obviously. Did your mother cook?
She was cooking for us all the time. She baked a lot, and I love to bake with her and my grandmother as well. That's a huge influence that she and tradition that she taught to us. She also picked up when we got a little bit older, and because she was cooking so much, she started her own company as a personal chef for local families.
Your mom did?
Yeah.
Oh, that's
wonderful. So she was working at home, staying at home, and then there were about three other families at one point that she was actually cooking meals for and delivering them. She would cook from our home, and it would be great because we would have all these big gourmet meals every single night, and they had a whole bunch of different dietary preferences for all the different children, and then she would go and deliver them later on. So it was nice because it kept her at home, it kept her busy, it kept her pursuing her passion. So that was nice to always be there in the kitchen assisting her as well.
What were some of her signature dishes?
The one that resonates the most with me right now is her turkey dinner. Like her classic Christmas, Thanksgiving turkey dinner with the stuffing and the potatoes. And that's something we would ask for all times of the year from
her. So walk us through the whole meal.
The whole meal. Ooh. So definitely the classic turkey that she would spend hours and hours on, stuffed with stuffing on the side, of course, because my sister didn't like the stuffing in the turkey. And roasted potatoes. She did the most incredible roasted potatoes, oven roasted, using Montreal steak spice was her secret.
Montreal steak spice.
I go to Costco now whenever I'm there and buy huge vats of it and bring it back. That's like my secret sauce or spice. And mashed turnip that she would put maple syrup in. So it was like a mashed potato texture, but turnip with maple syrup. Her stuffing was the best. Her stuffing was a sage, celery, and onion stuffing. And my favorite part was ripping the bread. That was like my job as a child every single year. And what else do we have there? Pumpkin pie, of course, that some years got twisted into pumpkin cheesecake and pumpkin apple and all different variations of it. And gravy. A good traditional fatty gravy.
Are things like cranberries?
Yes.
A Canadian thing?
It is. Cranberry sauce. And she actually would make a cranberry sauce, boiling the cranberries and the sugar. And she used, what was it? She used the orange liqueur was her, what she boiled them in. And I copy it all the time.
You do.
I have all of her recipes and that's my go-to. I'm trying to carry on the tradition there.
So what would you help it? You said you tore the bread, but did you do other things just in general in the kitchen?
Yes, in the kitchen. I would definitely help with the prep, but my passion was setting the table. That was what I loved to do, and doing these big, crazy, elaborate table settings for the holidays and theming it every year. We could never do the same thing. We could never use the same decorations any year. And we had, my father built a 16-person table out of vintage barn wood, and it had drawers in it. Every single person had a drawer underneath, and I painted the inside of the drawers with chalkboard. So then we would write little notes to everybody at the table. We would put our cutlery in the drawers, and we would just have so much fun creating these amazing tablescapes with like these long vintage wooden tables.
Yeah. When did you realize that was a skill you had?
I guess at a very young age. I think we look back, and it's funny because my mom always talks about it. She looks back and remembers pictures from the holidays when we were like, I'd say probably about 10 or 12. I was always into arts and crafts. That was always my thing. Every year I was making ornaments for the tree. I was, you know, playing with a variety of different leaf pressing techniques, making placemats for Thanksgiving and in wax paper and an iron. And I think that just kind of transpired. At a young age, arts and crafts were, you know, part of it. But then to come 13, 14, that was like my job, was making everything beautiful.
Were you a Martha Stewart fan?
Huge.
I'm trying to think who would have been your inspiration back
then.
Yeah,
when she had her show, of course. I would fake sick very often and stay home and lie in my parents' bed and watch it. That was a huge inspiration for me. It was one of the only ones, too, back then. There wasn't too many other people I can think of.
I wasn't sure if you had a Canadian Martha Stewart.
No,
Martha
unfortunately.
Martha was the Canadian Martha Stewart.
There's a few like City Line, which is one of the like local programming shows on the Rogers Network that would always have those few little entertaining segments, but not one person. It was Martha. She's God of the world.
You must have met her by now. Have you?
I was at an event with her, and I could not get the courage to go up to her. I chickened out. I was standing right beside her, like shoulder to shoulder, dying to say something, and I just froze. I couldn't do it.
She's actually great. I mean, we've done a lot with her at this point, but she can be intimidating.
I'll confess,
every time we work with her, I'm a little nervous.
And I've been fine. I've met many different celebrities, and I'll, you know, go up to so many of them, not a problem. But that one, I just couldn't. Maybe because she's so high up there on my list.
You'll love the story. We did Cherry Bomb University in the fall, and we gave two honorary doctorates, one to Christina Tosi and one to Martha. And we had a whole ceremony on stage in the high school auditorium, and a bunch of the kids were there and a lot of people from the bomb squad. And Christina was interviewing Martha. And we had this like really sad banner that said like Cherry Bomb University on it or something. And no one had ironed it. And I didn't even notice until like 5 minutes before the program starts. And, you know, because you do events, when you have a big event, there are certain things you just have to be like, I will live with this. So I'm like, I'll live with the wrinkled banner. So we present the awards. Christina interviews Martha. It's the very end. I go up to say thank you to everybody. The banner falls off, right? It had been held up with all this like mashed up masking tape. So all anybody sees is this crumpled banner and just like gobs of masking tape. So everyone starts laughing, right? And I said, well, obviously Martha didn't hang that. And everyone starts laughing again. And I look over at Martha and she goes, and no one ironed it either. And I don't think anyone heard that because she was off mic at that point, but I totally heard it and saw it as she said it. And I was like, of course. She walked in, she noticed that that thing wasn't ironed.
Oh, so that's great.
Lesson there, you can't get anything past Martha.
Yeah, yeah. And that's why there's so much intimidation. I'd be so afraid that you'd say something wrong or do something wrong. And she's just God of perfection. Yeah.
So college.
Yes.
Next up is college. What did you study?
So I studied fashion design, far from what I'm doing now. Fashion design and specialized in, I started off there, realized that sewing and pattern drafting was not for me very quickly, and then branched into the marketing and PR side of things, which I really fell in love with. I loved the branding element of it, everything from, you know, the merchandising, more of the aesthetic side of it. And the shows, we would put on like different productions, work with different brands and do various fashion shows. I was hosting a lot of our own events inside school as well. So that was just something that I really found kind of like my knack in that.
Did you have a sense of where all this would be? Would head?
Not a clue.
No.
Not a clue. Yeah.
So tell us how you wound up in Montreal, because that was sort of the next big thing in your life, right?
So I wound up in Montreal because I stayed locally going to school. I was in Toronto. I really missed that going away experience and that university experience. I lived it vicariously through my friends on weekends going to all the frat parties and coming back home for school on Sunday night.
Did you live at home while you went to school?
I did. I lived at home and I just commuted. So I really felt that I missed that experience. And with my mom, you know, being so wonderful, I'm like, I need to learn how to do my own laundry, Mom. I've never washed a dish in my life. I don't know how to make coffee. I'm like, I need to do this for myself. So
Why did you ever leave?
I know. I look back at it now, and I'm like, God, it's so good. What was I thinking?
Does your mom need roommates?
She's, I know. No, but I fly her in very often to come and stay with me. She just left last week. I'm like, my fridge in my apartment has never been so spotless. So I finished school. I was working in the fashion industry as well. I was working for Page Denim, and I was spending a lot of time back and forth to Montreal. I was sales repping with the brand. I was doing a lot of visits there, and I just fell in love with the city. I had my father's grew up there. My grandparents were there, and it was kind of just like a fun party town too. So I wanted to be somewhere where I was far enough away that I could be independent, but then I was still close enough that if I wanted to come home, it was just a short trip away to come home. So Montreal was a good fit, and the cute Frenchman helped as well. And so when I moved there, I had to somehow come up with a way for my parents to still support me. So I needed to incorporate an element of education because they said, we'll pay for your schooling. And after that, you kids are on your own. So I had to be creative and come up with school. And I really realized that I loved the event side of the fashion industry in that world. And I found a course at LaSalle College that offered nighttime classes for event planning. And I jumped on it and I took that course there. It was a year and a half program. Exceptionally, exceptionally easy, but still
easy because
fun.
You had a natural
I
affinity
think so.
For it.
Yeah, I think so, and I think it's, you know, it's the kind of thing. There's only so much you can learn in school for that kind of industry. You know, like there's so much.
You really
like 80% of what I know is physically being there and doing it and learning from mistakes and learning from actually experiencing it. So,
yeah, I'm so curious. What is the syllabus for event planning? You're like, we're going to dissect the Met Ball and how they put together the
Actually,
Met Ball.
No, that's a good example because there were a lot of elements like that. You know, I think the most interesting one would have been kind of like the budgeting course. So there's an accounting course and budgeting and allocating. There was a logistics course. There was sales and marketing. There was an entrepreneur course, just kind of all about, you know, starting your own business, you know, working on a business plan, building that up. And funny, actually, at that time, one of my best friends and myself, who we were taking the course together, one of our projects was starting this company in somewhat relating to the event planning field. And I was a very passionate baker, obviously, and loved baking. And I was doing a lot of events in Montreal. And I found that everyone was asking for cupcakes and sweet tables, which back in that day was the huge trend at the time. And there weren't a lot of people who were doing it and doing it well. And so one of my projects, which actually eventually turned into a real company, was a cupcake and sweet confectionery catering company. So my friend and I did this. This was our final year project. And then after that, we turned it into a real life venture. And I started my own company selling cupcakes and doing some really amazing creative designs with them as well. That kind of led me into the wedding world.
So I think it's really interesting that you can go study event planning. I think that's good for a lot of the listeners to know who are either younger and maybe want to get into that or career switchers. Like everybody is desperate to throw events, brands, yeah. People. So I really do think it's one of those careers
and
of the future.
For sure. And I'm sure the course has evolved quite a bit over time because looking back on it now, I'm still in touch with a teacher who I had who was wonderful. And I was asking her about the curriculum now and what the program's like because my year was the first year ever that they invented this course. So I think a lot of it was pulled from, you know, various courses, various teachers. I think that they were kind of trying to figure it out as they go. And social media wasn't even a thing then. So now it's a whole new world, and I'm sure the curriculum is very useful, but you know, most of what I learned was definitely at the time voluntarily not part of the schooling. I was interning with a wedding planner as well, so that's where I learned what I needed to learn.
For those who've never thrown a big event, it's a lot of work.
Oh yeah,
the women we work with for Jubilee and our other events just blow me away because there's so much to it.
There's so many layers.
Yeah. So many logistics. So let's jump ahead to Mama.
Yeah.
So how did Mama come to be?
So it was a very kind of complex situation I was in. I had a 9-to-5 working fashion PR. I was doing event planning school at night. I had a cupcake catering company on the side, and I was interning with a wedding planner. And in addition to that, because I wasn't busy enough, I was doing some freelance interior design work as well, because that was also a passion of mine. And I got to a point in my life where I had kind of a multitude of passions and jobs, and it became frustrating because I was really giving only 20% of my energy and my efforts to each thing because I just couldn't physically do it. There wasn't enough time in the day. And I got to a point where I had to like look at my career and say, okay, what do I want to do? What do I love the most? And I couldn't figure it out. I really genuinely enjoyed everything I was doing from branding to interiors to, you know, baking. And there wasn't one thing that really stood out among the rest. And when I tried to look at it and find this job that I wanted, it didn't exist. And so I knew I had to create it. And I knew if I wanted to do something that I loved doing, if I wanted to do many things that I loved doing, it would have to be something that I invented and I would have to work for myself. And I think that obviously, you know, was instilled from both of my parents being entrepreneurs and working for themselves is you need to create a world that you love to live and you need to create a job that you love to come to every day. So that's kind of really the basis of where Maman came from and creating this world that I can encompass everything that I love doing under one roof.
So did you move to New York? What? Tell us the in-between steps.
So coincidentally, at that time, I met Ben, my partner, and he was a corporate lawyer living in Montreal. And on our second date, he said, I want to open a restaurant. I'm done with the corporate world. And I said, really? Because I have this concept. I want to open a bakery. That's an event venue. That's a shop. And basically explain my mom. And it was an interesting time because right after we first met, his friends own a hospitality group based over in Europe, the Experimental Group. And they have a variety of different hotels and restaurants and, you know, wonderful bars over in Europe. And they reached out to him with a new opportunity because they were opening up a restaurant in Ibiza on the beach. And, you know, he was discussing it with them as whether he would invest. So we ended up looking into it more. And then we kind of came together and we're like, you know what, let's just do it. Let's just quit everything. It was really a position that like embodied a lot of what I loved and what I wanted to do. We were building a restaurant from the ground up. So there was a design and a decor element. There were weddings that they had 8 weddings booked already for the previous season. Plus there were, I had to install a whole new wedding program. There was definitely branding and marketing that fell into place. And it was really like going to like restaurant school 101. And then of course there was the cooking and the baking and all of those other elements. So for me, it was a nice stepping stone to kind of get my feet wet in that industry and see if it was something that I love to do.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our friends at Le Cordon Bleu. Are you daydreaming about culinary school again? Make this the year your dreams become reality with Le Cordon Bleu, the legendary culinary school. Study classic French culinary techniques in cuisine and pâtisserie as part of their exclusive 9-month Le Grand Diplôme and graduate into a world of opportunity. You also can extend your course of studies to include culinary management and dedicated internships. Le Cordon Bleu has locations in more than 20 countries around the world and located within some of the best food cities out there: London, Ottawa, Madrid, Bangkok, Tokyo, and of course, the spiritual home of cuisine and Le Cordon Bleu, Paris. Turning your daydreams into reality is closer than ever. Visit cordonbleu.edu for more and let your culinary adventure begin.
100 Bogart has made much progress over the past year since their grand opening. They are a growing community of professional freelancers, entrepreneurs, and startups. Their dedicated team guarantees you receive a productive and worry-free work environment. 100 Bogart is currently filling up their 2-person to 12-person private offices. The spacious pop-up gallery, premier rooftop, and brand new full floor with terrace are available for your next event. Podcast rooms, conference rooms, and meeting spaces are also available for booking. 100 Bogart hosts events like art exhibitions, pop-up stores, product launches, and fashion shows. Heritage Radio Network is a proud member of the 100 Bogart community and often holds events in the building. Visit 100bogart.com to schedule a tour and learn more.
And we're back. Right before the break, Elisa was telling us about her new and unexpected life in Ibiza. Fast forward 2 years, she and her partner moved to New York to open a wine bar. She realized the wine world wasn't quite for her, but she had a vision for a cozy, beautiful coffee shop inspired by her mom and pivoted in that direction. Let's return to our conversation with Elisa Marshall of Maman.
So tell people what Mama is.
So that's something I'm trying to figure out too, because it's really a bit of a multitude of many different elements. I think it really kind of started off as a coffee shop, bakery, cafe, and then event space. So your day-to-day, it's, you know, order at the counter, lounge seating in the back. And since then, it's evolved quite a bit, events being a core part of it. But the events I really wanted to keep on the smaller side of things. So I wanted to keep it, you know, max 50 people. I wanted to do events that I could customize and bring life into. And really the aesthetic of it and the vibe of it. And I think in a city like New York, where it's not home for a lot of people, I wanted to create a place that felt like home. And Mama, for those of you who don't know, means mother in French. And I wanted to recreate that homey vibe. I felt in New York when I was here working there, I was working remotely a lot of places, and I was always in coffee shops, and everything was just trying so hard to be cool, and everything was so sterile and industrial chic, and I'm like, I want to go somewhere that's not my home, that feels like I'm, you know, at my mom's house and somewhere really comfortable and warm and welcoming. And even from an event perspective as well, when I was looking into the event industry in New York, there was also nothing like that. And for entertaining, because it's something that's so important to me and growing up, we had, you know, huge dining room tables and china hutches with my grandma's flatware. And people love entertaining at home, but half of us in New York don't even have kitchens, let alone, you know, dining room tables that could seat, you know, more than four people. So I really wanted to kind of recreate a space that was an extension of someone's home or their grandmother's home or their mom's home, where they could have amazing food, you know, be in a beautiful multi-sensory environment and just be comfortable. That was really kind of the ethos of Mama when we first started.
And now you have 8 locations?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That's amazing. And you grew pretty quickly.
Yeah, in 4.5 years, we just opened our last one, about 2 weeks ago.
And you are in Brooklyn, Manhattan, and Toronto?
Yes.
Do you still have a location up
there? Yeah, we do.
Yeah. How often do you go back?
Not as much as I should. We're going back on Wednesday, actually. But we have great partners up there who are really running and managing it. We're very fortunate to have that. So I try and get back as much as I can.
So people who listen to the show always want to know how things are financed. So how did you go from 1 to 8?
So we were self-financed when we started. It was kind of all of our savings from numerous weddings when we opened up our first one. And then in terms of scaling, we grew reaching out to friends and family for money. And actually, I've been doing the same thing since then. So we have investors, Ben's brother, and he owns a large hotel group. So they've invested in us, which has been nice. So it's still kept in the family. We don't have any outside.
So you're still independent.
Still, yeah.
Independently owned. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah, wow. Just the two of us. And it's nice just the two of us, too. Yeah. It's not too many pieces of the pie and too many decisions. It's really just Ben and myself.
What have you had to learn about the financial side that you maybe didn't know a few years ago?
Everything. It's funny. That's one of the things that I'm very thankful that I have Ben for, because if I didn't have him, I would not be where I am today. We would have not made it past our first week. I can hardly count past 20, and numbers and math are not my strength. And, you know, I'm very fortunate when I look back on it. I'm thankful that in venturing into my own business, that's something that I realized and I identified very quickly. I knew all my strengths and I knew what I was very good at and what I wanted to do. But the fact that I really needed to focus on my weaknesses and know what do I really suck at, because where do I need help, and then fill in other people there in that element.
So tell us what your responsibilities are at Mama.
Ooh, it depends on the day. Some days I wash dishes, make coffee. I really right now I'm taking on more of a creative director kind of role. I think I really like to get my hands dirty in everything. I, you know, do a lot of the events just because I find passion in that, and that's really what I love to do the most. So I've really focus a lot on the event side of things, but I'm starting to kind of step back and look on the overall and the growth of the company and the growth of the brand. So we're doing a lot of different private label collaborations now. We have everything from a candle that just came out with Apotheke to, you know, to a line of dishware that we're working on, to, you know, a cookbook that's in the works as well.
Good. Did you get a deal?
Not yet. We're in the proposal stage.
Good.
So yeah, still in the early stage. But for me, it's been really fun to kind of create this brand that's not so pigeonholed, that there's so many different elements to it, and there's so much that we can build on and do with it.
Because you could be the next Martha Stewart.
That's
I don't know.
Goal.
You probably don't wake up and think that in the morning.
Oh, every single morning. Yeah, I do.
Because just listening to you, it's really remarkable how every passion you've had since you were, 10, setting the table, have all kind of come together today in what you do at Mama.
No, it's been fun, and I think it's been, I'm very fortunate that I've been able to build this world for myself and, you know, be successful in it and genuinely get to do what I love every day.
So my favorite is your Tribeca location, because
Me too.
Our office used to be right up the block from there. So we would have a lot of meetings there and different things. And love your food, love it. And it's so funny, you know, there just aren't a lot of places to go. Have a beautiful salad, a quiche, a breakfast sandwich, things like that. The names of all your items. Mm-hmm. Who are all these women who the things are named after?
It started off being named after people who gave us those recipes. And we would reach out to a lot of friends and family for recipes. Everything from my aunt to my sister had a salad. The Janice sandwich, which is still around, is the egg salad sandwich, which is my mom, Janice. And that was her recipe and something that I had growing up. And now it's been fun and we've extended it on to employees. When our chef, of course, like creates recipes, we have them inspire who inspired that recipe. And maybe it's just a tweak of her aunt's avocado toast that she's making. But we wanted to kind of bring, you know, life to the food as well and bring a story to all of the food that's there.
So you very kindly brought us a box of baked goods.
Yes.
So why don't you open it and walk us through what's in there so people can get a sense of what they can try when they
go
visit.
For sure. So this is just the sweet side of things. So I'll start with one of our newest and latest creations. We are very well known for our lavender hot chocolate, which is a hot chocolate, and we infuse our milk with lavender when we steam it. And we have recently turned that into a tart. So we have our lavender hot chocolate pie, which is like a salted chocolate crust with a chocolate ganache and then a lavender cream on the top. Then we have a Nutella brownie. We like to kind of take a lot of childhood classics and do twists on them. Of course, you know, your good old-fashioned classic brownie recipe, adding Nutella into it. We also have our classic nutty chocolate chip cookie. So this is kind of our cookie that I think really put us on the map. It's, you know, we were named to have the best cookie in New York City. And from that day on, we've had lineups and so much around this, which has been wonderful.
Tell us what makes the cookie unique.
It is quite a nice texture combination. So it is a really rich Guittard dark chocolate that we use. We also have macadamia nuts, which are salted. We have whole almonds and we have walnuts in there. There's also some salt in the batter as well. So I think the contrast of the sweet and the salt and the gooey cookie and the crunchy nuts just kind of really creates a wonderful flavor, which you guys can try and be the judge after. I'm like, I'm biased, but it's my favorite. Then we also have our newest cookie, which is a cranberry white chocolate and orange cookie. We have our vanilla oatmeal raisin cookie. So that one we just made into a candle. We just captured that smell. It was a very fun testing process. I'm sure more fun for Chrissy at Apotheke, who had to keep sending cookies to master and figure out how to capture that smell into a candle. And then we also have a pistachio loaf cake as well, and a croissant.
Oh my God, so thank you for bringing
lunch
all that. Wow, no
and
kidding.
Dessert and dinner.
No kidding. Well, hopefully all the Bomb Squad's going to go visit. And now it's nice because we know how many personal touches are in the spaces. So, well, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
It was great to get to know you a little better.
Good. You guys too. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed our chat with Elisa. We're going to take a break for a word from Vital Farms pasture-raised eggs, and then we'll be right back with Linda Thatch of Little Skips. Does this happen to you? You need a dozen eggs. You go to the supermarket. You head to the egg section, and you are so confused by what you find there, you freeze. You want nice eggs on hand because maybe you want a cheese and herb omelet for dinner, or you want to poach an egg to slip on your avocado toast, and you know quality eggs make a big difference. And you're a decent person, so it's important that chickens have a good life. But as you stand there, you think to yourself, I have no idea what all these words on the egg cartons mean. So you shrug, pick one, and continue shopping. Stop right there. You are a busy lady. You don't need this bullshit in your life. You need bullshit-free eggs, which is where Vital Farms pasture-raised eggs come in. Their pasture-raised hens roam outside in 108 square feet of space per hen. Those cage-free hens, they never go outside. I tasted the difference once I tried Vital Farms eggs. Try for yourself. To get your coupon for Vital Farms pasture-raised eggs, head to vitalfarms.com/cherrybomb. Next up, we have Linda Thatch, the founder and owner of the Little Skips Coffee Shops and the new Little Mo Restaurant, all in Bushwick, Brooklyn. As a fellow coffee shop owner, I've wanted to talk to Linda forever to hear how she does it. She's such an inspiration. She's working hard to make her shops as green as possible, and she's, how do I describe it? She's kind of fearless. After our talk with Linda, we have a quick bonus chat with Linda's mentee, Erica Costa, a young cook from the Philippines who is a recent arrival in New York. This is Erica's first interview ever, and we're happy to welcome her to the Bomb Squad. Enjoy.
So tell me what your childhood was like in Florida.
So I grew up pretty poor until I was in high school. And then my dad, he had a business and then it started to do well, I think, when I was in high school. And then he built our first house, I think, when I was in ninth grade. And it was like the biggest thing I've ever seen. It had a pool and it was on like the bayou in Florida. And I felt like finally I've made it.
So you come to New York and you are going to school. What are you doing for a living?
My first job was at Ninja New York. So I was a Ninja server, which was very interesting.
I don't even know what Ninja New York is. Maybe that's a good thing.
Really?
No, I have no
idea.
You
have to go one time.
It still exists?
Yes,
it
still exists.
What is Ninja New York?
It's like this, it's a ninja restaurant. It's a Japanese restaurant where all the servers dress up like ninjas. Yeah, everyone's a ninja in there. So we had to wear full garb from the armbands to the pants to the feet, the leg wraps to the shoes. And then we had katanas that we would wear like in our backs, you know, attached to our, there's this thing that you have to wrap around, like the ninja top. And yeah, that was my first job.
Was it fun?
I loved it.
Yeah.
It was like acting to me. It was like my first acting gig because my interview consists of, can you scream? And I'm like, yeah, I can scream. He's like, can you jump? I'm like, yes, I can jump. And I had to show him.
What do you do that's ninja-like when you're taking the orders or serving the food?
Oh, like all the foods kind of are smoky, or they'll have like this little cotton that lights on fire that you have to go, ha! And then you really actually just throw a light on it. And then it goes, like it lights up. And then there's things that you have to do with your sword. It's very kitschy.
Did you ever injure anyone?
I didn't, but we did get our katanas revoked when someone went to do this to a customer and then cut his like really expensive tie and into his shirt and like cut him a little bit. No one could use their katanas after that. So we had to like, couldn't carry swords. And then it was really different after that. It wasn't as fun, but it was
great.
That's
insane.
Yeah.
Was the food any good?
The food was good then. And then when I went back a few years ago, it's definitely.
Quality had slipped.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you are literally and figuratively kicking ass at the ninja restaurant. What's next?
You know, I was taking the acting classes, going to new school, and I just continued to take on serving jobs in Japanese restaurants. So I applied at Masa, which was probably the most high-end Japanese restaurant I've ever worked at. That didn't last too long because it's so strict there, and I had to just, it was just so strict, and I didn't get to have fun. And
it's
I didn't.
It's so expensive.
It's like just to sit down, it's almost $500 a person.
So what's your go-to sushi place in New York?
Momoya. So Momoya on 7th Avenue. I used to work there. But I will say, after trying like just all different sushi restaurants, sometimes I'll just go by myself, sit at the bar. I think that Momoya is still like one of the best sushi restaurants. And it's been around for probably over 10 years now because I worked there before I opened Little Skips, which was almost 10 years ago. So it's been around for a while. It's like that kind of restaurant that's like, it's a Japanese version of a diner, but it's not diner food, but it's you know, obviously higher-end sushi. But I would serve celebrities there, and it was a nice place to work. And honestly, I think that's where I developed my passion for wanting to run a business.
Let's skip ahead. I'm sure no one ever makes skip puns with you. To Little Skips, at what point did you say to yourself, you know, I want my own business?
I would get in trouble a lot at Momoya. So I was definitely like a very, well, rebellious kid, also not the best employees. I would be the employee that I wouldn't want to have. Always late, always calling out, just like, you know, rather have fun and never really put my work in front of, you know, me having fun. And I rode my bike and I crashed around Central Park. And I was supposed to work that evening, but I came in because I was nearby and I was like scraped up. And she's like, Linda, you can't keep doing this. You have to be responsible. And she told me that I couldn't ride my bike anymore if I wanted to work there. And I thought, well, that's silly. Like, I love riding my bike. But then, I still work there, but it made me think about it. And it's like, well, I'm always getting yelled at. I'm tired of this. I could do this, I could probably do something on my own. And I love the industry. So I thought like, and I realized too that acting was so competitive and I didn't like auditioning. I didn't like the cattiness of people and just the, like, I'm not a competitive person, like in a game or a sport. If you want to win, I will let you win. So that's how I felt about acting. I felt like it was so competitive, but I didn't care. Like I didn't want to win. But maybe that was just lack of confidence then, lack of skill in the craft, who knows. But I just decided this is obviously going to be too hard. And I also felt that my race was a big factor in the reason it made it harder, so there was not a lot of parts for me to audition for. And it was really, it just kind of, got me down. But I knew that I loved serving and I knew that I wanted to have a restaurant. So, all of those things put together with just like kind of being tired of getting yelled at work. And I had money in the bank that I was kind of leaving there that my mom left me. And I wanted to make sure that I used it for something good. So when I thought about what I could do with it, I thought, I would try to open a restaurant that would serve Southeast Asian food. But that didn't happen right away.
Why did you go the coffee shop route?
I realized once I started building and doing the research that a full-on restaurant was way too expensive. It was a lot more money than I had in my budget. And I just wasn't ready. I think that I was kind of over, I was just too ambitious. And so I thought, well, maybe just start with a coffee shop. And I could possibly do banh mi's to start. But then realizing that I would need to like cook the meat and pickle the stuff. And it was just so much work. So I started with just grilled cheese. So I looked into what it would take to run a coffee shop. That's when I interviewed Counterculture and Stumptown, Intelligentsia, and all the big roasters at the time, and got pricing for machinery. And then Counterculture also offered like their consulting services. And they're like, well, here, we'll come in and we've done this so many times. We'll just kind of help guide you through. And I thought, oh my God, this is what I need right now. So I decided to go with Counterculture, buy a machine through them. And that's just how it started.
Do you remember what your initial investment was?
So I had $40,000 was what was left of what my mom left me. And then I asked my dad for $20,000. And then I ran out of money. So I had to find an investor when I was very close to opening. And I found an investor who ended up becoming an operating partner, and he gave me $20,000. So I think the total, probably with some extra that I had to like maybe keep ask. I remember asking my father a few times. So I think, that comes to about $80,000 already. So I think it's probably a little more than $80,000.
That's not a lot.
Not a lot.
Even for a coffee shop.
Yeah, but I mean, you have to, if you saw Little Skips back then, you would understand, because it was like, I YouTubed how to put the tiles up. And so I bought a case of tiles at the tile shop down the street. And I was watching YouTube while I was trying to put the tiles up. And I'm like, oh, this is easy. I could do this. So the tiles that are in Little Skips right now, I put up.
What, were you a coffee expert back then?
No, I loved coffee, and I would spend a lot of time in coffee shops back then, just reading, writing, and I like the atmosphere. But I grew up just, sneaking my dad's coffee, and I've always loved, coffee ice cream was the ice cream that was in my fridge growing up. But I didn't know anything about it when I started. And when Counterculture offered their training program and I realized how extensive it was, I'm like, this is great. This is like coffee university. Why not?
Can you pull a shot now?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's what I did for the first 5 years of my life.
You did?
Oh, yeah. Wow. Okay. I just 6 days a week, my partner and I would switch off one day to have off. So for the first, I think, definitely 2 years solid, it was 6 days a week and it was both of us working. And then we had my friend who was living with me. I just asked him, hey, can you help out? And so he would help out. So it was like three of us. And then my other friend would help out sometimes. And it just became like, okay, my friends are going to help. And I worked on bar pretty much until I opened the second location. And then when the second location opened, I was on bar there too. So
what made you decide to do the second location?
We were just too busy. Little Sips became, I call it a beast. And it is, you know, it was lines to the door every single day. And it was just to the point where we just were under so much stress and so much pressure. And just, you know, I could tell, and my staff was just dying. And I thought, and a lot of it was just coffee. So people would stand in line for sometimes 20 minutes, 30 minutes for a cup of coffee. And it was crazy to me. So I thought, well, if I could open like a little outpost location and just do coffee, that would alleviate the lines here, which we did. And to be honest, people still want to wait in line. It didn't happen the way I thought it would. We have a new clientele at Baby Skips now. And the clientele that has been going to Little Skips still prefers to get their coffee there, still prefers to wait in line there.
What do you think the magic is?
I don't know. I tell you, it's right when I walked into that space, I felt something magical. And I talk about that all the time. And it's really unique. It's still old. I think it has just so much character and so much charm because we've left, like, the hardwood floors are still there from the original space. The ceilings, the same tin ceilings. We took the sign, Ashley's carburetor sign from outside, and we hung it inside. And I think that that's part of it. Plus, it's, you know, coffee shops these days are different. Like, you see, my new spaces are different. And the what Brooklyn was back then when I opened is what Little Skips is. You don't find that a lot anymore. Things are being gutted and renovated and everything is like shiny and new now. But Little Skips is still not.
Tell us about your third place.
The third coffee shop, Little Skips East, was a little bit different. There was a friend of mine, he's also a real estate agent. He was representing the owner of the building who bought the building, opened a coffee shop in it, and for about 2 years he ran it. He was in there 7 days a week. He's never, like, that was, you know, so not even one day off. And so I think he was just ready to get out of the business. And he said, I'm not a coffee person. Like, I this was fun. I learned a lot. And I wanted to build a community around the new building that I bought because I'm invested now for the long term. But he wanted someone to ensure that we would continue to assimilate into the community and be a part of it. So this friend of mine said, I know just the person. And then he reached out to me and I'm like, oh my gosh. I'm like, I'm just going to entertain you, which everyone, I mean, I get like people email me and call me all the time. Hey, I have this space. And so this is the one time I was like, okay, I'll go see it. And as soon as I walked in, I felt it. It felt the same as walking into Little Skips, you know, years ago. So I decided to take the space. And then last June, 2017.
And what's the concept there? Same thing?
It's a little different. So all the spaces are a little bit different. Our coffee menu stays the same, but at every location, we do a different coffee. So every espresso is different at each location. All the drip is different and all the cold brew is different. So the coffee program is similar, but the food at every location is different. The food at this place, we have like a flat top grills, which just came with the space. I'm like, okay, let's use it. So we do eggs. We do like scrambled eggs. So we do like a lot of breakfast foods, which is something that Little Skips doesn't do. And I know people have been asking for. So I thought, okay, we have a flat top. Let's do breakfast for people. So it's really breakfast focused.
Tell us about the fourth place.
Well, the fourth place is a restaurant. So Little Mo is actually what Little Skips was supposed to be. I say it's like Southeast Asian fusion because we do have like a bulgogi cheesesteak on there. But it's very much non-traditional, but it is food that I recognize that I grew up with. So it's banh mi's. It's the chicken soup, which is like a chicken pho. But that's something that I always make at home and I grew up eating. And so that's on the menu 5 days a week. And then we do a pho, which is my other favorite dish when I was in college. And my mom would ask me what I would want every weekend when I came home. It would be the same two things. It would be spring rolls one day and pho one day. And that's something that I have like really fond memories of growing up making pho with her. And, you know, how long it took. We would always start the night before, which is the same way we do it at Little Mo, and the same ingredients. So I used oxtail in mine, and that's what my mom always put in our pho along with the beef bones. So the recipe is pretty much, you know, exactly how it took a while to get it to that point, because I've never made pho in like a pot so big, but it was fun to play around to get it to, you know, finally taste the way my mom made it.
So I want to go back to when you said you were the worst employee when you worked at the sushi restaurant. How do you handle your employees knowing that you were like them a decade ago?
I think that's why I'm able to handle them. So I just kind of sit them down and talk to them the way that I wish someone would have talked to me. And that's like the most important part, because I think most of my jobs, no one cared. So I think if I can give my employees the care that I didn't have, then I can build a better group of employees for Little Skips.
I also want to talk to you about the green thing, because that's how
my
you
favorite subject
came to my attention. I was talking to the people at Counterculture about how I wanted to take my coffee shop single-use plastic free and what could we do. And I've talked to other people in the coffee world, and I'm a little disappointed in the coffee world that they are not focused on this. Really at all. There are a handful of people across the country who are. Yeah. And when I say handful, I mean a handful. So when was your green awakening and what have you been doing?
I mean, I've always been obsessively, I think it's just because I was that kid that was always, you know, I would cry if I would see trash in the ocean. I would like go get it. I would pick up everything that I would come across that was trash. It's always hurt me. So I think that that's where it comes from. It's just been something that's part of my being. And I realize slowly as I'm running a business that it's so wasteful. Like everything we do, we produce so much waste as a coffee shop. I have a regular that comes in every day and sometimes 2-3 times a day for a nice coffee. Cup, lid, straw. And I'm like, I will buy you a reusable cup. Why don't you just... But the mentality is, he said to me, I like to just throw it away. I don't understand. So it's just a different mentality that we have to shift. And so I actually sat him down and I explained, let's do the multiplication. You know, I'm very vocal about it. You know, if a regular is coming in, I'm not beyond telling them that they need to consider bringing their own cup. And I've actually made it a policy because Baby Skips and Little Mo are connected. So I do an exchange. So Baby Skips gets a meal from Little Mo and Little Mo can get free coffee from Baby Skips. But I notice that every time it's the kitchen in front of the house from Mo is coming over and getting a new cup every single time. So now there's a policy. They do not get coffee if they don't bring a reusable cup. But I did. I went to Family Dollar and just bought a bunch of reusable cups and thermoses and put them in the kitchen. And they just bring them over now. And it's just so nice. Think about how many times they come over throughout the day and how many employees we have, two shifts. And it's crazy. Just my employees alone, you use so many cups. And I thought that I can't.
Well, and then also complicating it are the New York City health code regulations that the cups have to be covered.
Yeah. We have those now.
For
so
the
they
employees.
For the employees, yeah. But you can buy the cups with the top and the plastic straw that goes in. So
it's tough. I get nervous because I don't want people to feel like I'm plastic shaming them. But I have been converting. I do feel like I'm converting people one cup at a time. Mm-hmm. And I do think a lot of it is sharing this information with your guests and letting them know what you're trying to do and what a difference they can make.
Yeah.
And we keep putting the number of cups we've kept out of the landfill on our sandwich board outside.
That's right. I saw that. That's a really great idea.
And it's a great visual because you can visualize 2,000 paper and plastic cups. Mm-hmm. And when you visualize that, you're like, whoa, I would like to be part of the solution, mm-hmm. not part of the problem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what we hope.
All right, we're going to segue over to our friend Erica. who's in the studio with us.
Hi.
Erica is a radio newbie, right? This is your first radio interview?
Yes.
Excellent.
Very excited.
Tell us your full name and your title.
I'm Erica. I'm the kitchen manager of Little Skips. I've been helping Linda for like 3 years. I love food. I love helping her. I love working at Skips. It's like a great place for me. I feel like being in this establishment, like I do belong there. And everybody's really nice. Like, you know, it's New York. Not everybody's nice. And this place is like, I love it. It's like a family.
Where are you from?
I'm from Philippines.
Uh-huh. So when did you move to America?
I moved here when I was like 17. And it's very new for me.
How did you find the Little Skips universe, or did it find you?
It was crazy because I was applying to a Vietnamese restaurant first because I love to just cook. But then they responded really fast and I had to check it out. I have never been to Bushwick. I just pass it, like, you know, and they interviewed me. I was really nervous because I just dyed my hair purple like crazy. I was like, are they going to hire me? You know, like, oh, this person's probably not responsible. She got, like, purple hair.
Linda's hair has been a few different colors, but if Linda's, I remember correctly.
Yeah, Linda's hair was blue, and I'm like, okay, I'm good. And now it's been, like, 3 years. And I don't know, I just feel like Linda just opens up doors for me. Like, this whole new baby kitchen that we want to go local. We want to always compost. I love that. Like, you know, it's like she opened my eyes to that.
That's it for today's show. Thank you to Elisa Marshall of Mama. If you are going to be in Manhattan, Brooklyn, or Toronto, be sure to go visit. And thank you to Linda Thatch and Erica Costa for talking to us as well. If you're ever in Bushwick, stop by one of the Little Skips locations and grab a cup of coffee. In a reusable cup, of course. 2019 is the year of everyone being an environmentalist, especially everyone in the bomb squad. If you don't have a reusable cup yet, what are you waiting for? Hashtag eco-chic, people. And don't forget, Jubilee Early Bird tickets are on sale right now at cherrybomb.com. They are $250 on sale through January 15th or until they sell out. And don't miss the new issue of Cherry Bomb magazine. Subscribe through our website and get our brand new issue featuring cover girl and wellness advocate Sophia Rowe, or stop by one of our favorite stockists like Omnivore Books in San Francisco. Thank you to our sponsors, Vital Farms Pasture-Raised Eggs and Le Cordon Bleu Culinary School, for supporting Radio Cherry Bomb. Thank you to our associate producer and our very own riot girl, Jess Zeidman, and to the band Tra La La for our theme song. Today's podcast was recorded at The Wing in Dumbo. The Wing is a work and community space for women, designed by women. For more information about The Wing, visit the-wing.com. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb Magazine and the Heritage Radio Network. Thanks for listening, everyone. You're the bomb.
I'll have what she's having.
Next year, Heritage Radio Network is turning 10. For the last decade, we've been committed to bringing listeners around the world the very best in food radio, for free. Our small staff and incredible network of hosts work hard so that listeners can tune in each week to hear the important conversations in food policy, stay on the cutting edge of cocktail culture, and hear the latest updates in food tech. But there is no HRN without the support of listeners like you. Become a member of Heritage Radio Network today and help HRN get a strong start to our second decade. Choose from exclusive member gifts and stay in the loop on discounts to upcoming events. There's no better time to show your support. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate and wish HRN a happy birthday.
Radio Cherry Bomb is powered by Simplecast. Simplecast is a popular hosting and analytics platform that allows podcasters to easily host and publish to apps like Apple Podcasts. If you have a podcast or are looking to create your very first, check it out. Try it for free and save half off your first 3 months at simplecast.com/heritage.